Welcome back to another episode of Veritas, the truth behind Asian Americans and affirmative action. It's me, Tara. If you've been a previous listener, you might remember me from episode 6, Spilling the Cha, Subtle Asian American Perspectives, where we talked about underrepresented viewpoints of Asian minorities and first-gen low-income students. Many of you, I hope, are listening to this safe from the comfort of your home. Any proceeds from this episode will be donated to pandemic relief funds. Thank you, listener, for wearing a mask, practicing social distancing, and doing your part. So, you're probably wondering, COVID-19 and affirmative action? What do these things have to do with each other? And why do they matter to you applying for college? In this episode, we're joined by two guests as we discuss college admissions, anti-Asian sentiments during this global pandemic, and the context behind two major affirmative action cases in the media at the moment.
Hi, my name's Alice. I graduated from Harvard College in May. My senior thesis was about the socioeconomic effects of the Tulsa race massacre, kind of using census data from back in the day to look at those effects. And also trying to weave that in with reparative urban planning and community organizing and like themes in ethnic studies. Right now, I'm a master's in education student at the Harvard Graduate School of Education and planning on getting my teacher's license in history. And other stuff I'm currently working on is there's like an anti-racism petition going around and other initiatives going around for the Fremont Unified School District, my home school district. And so I've been like helping a little bit with that too.
Hi, my name's Olivia. I just graduated from Amherst College with a major in American Studies. And my senior thesis was exploring the experiences of social mobility amongst Chinese American women in immigrant families. So I did a pretty extensive oral history interview with my mom, and then I also interviewed other second generation Chinese American women at Amherst. Yeah, it was very fun. And right now I'm currently working with the Amherst Asian Alumni Network to do research on the history of Asian student experiences and Asian student activism at Amherst College, looking specifically into also the history of Asian American studies at Amherst.
I'm sure many of you have previously come into this podcast with some burning questions. One of them being, how do you get into somewhere like Harvard or any other top-ranking school? And how do you do it when you're Asian? During court proceedings of the recent Harvard admissions case, it was revealed that their admissions team consistently rated Asian American applicants lower on the personal score, marking them down in traits like likability, courage, kindness, and being widely respected. Rightly so, Asian Americans are in an uproar over this particular detail, as it shows that there's some degree of implicit bias in the admissions process, even if the overall system, as ruled by Judge Burroughs, does not illegally discriminate against Asian American applicants. The question that seems to arise then is, how can we subvert these stereotypes in our own applications?
For me, as a first-gen low-income student, I think that writing about those things in my college app helped my application a lot, just because I think comparatively to maybe some of my peers in my class, I don't think my application was as impressive, just because when I came into Amherst, I knew a lot of people who had a lot of awards or like things that they've won, and I didn't necessarily have all of those. And by writing about my own experiences, not having the resources to do certain things and not having the time either, since for the majority of my high school years, I worked a lot after school. So I didn't take part in a lot of extracurriculars, but I wrote about things that were important to me and how growing up in a certain way made me a lot more empathetic towards others, because I was the mediator in my family. I was the middle child, and writing about that was a big part of my college application. And so I guess for me, I would recommend to write truthfully and genuinely about themselves and not be afraid to write about their ethnic identity as an Asian American, since if you don't write about your Asian identity, then you're writing, I don't know, some weird watered down version of yourself, and that's probably not going to stand out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would definitely echo that. I think that amongst a lot of college counseling or college advice for Asian American students, they get advised not to write about their racial identity, and I definitely don't agree with that, because I think also, like, a lot of the advice I got too when I was applying, honestly, the best thing I did was to not listen to that, because even, like, I went to this one free consultation with some college counselor who we did not end up hiring because she was way too expensive. But besides that, like, her whole thing was about how, oh, I already showed enough interest in the humanities in what I did, so I needed to make myself more well-rounded by showing I also had an interest in science, even though that was, like, not something I was very interested in at all. So I, like, for one summer, I did, like, some science-y related stuff, and I was just like, this is not, I don't know, I don't feel that much passion for it, I'm not that excited for it. And then, like, the summer after that, actually ended up doing something that I was really interested in, which at the time was creative writing. And I think, like, leaning a lot more into that in my college application was something that also helped me be more successful. Not that I know exactly, but, like, talking about things that I had kind of, like, a very personal, strong interest in, I think that kind of genuineness does come across. And I would definitely, yeah, echo everything you said, Tara, for students to write really honestly about how they view their lives and their interests and where they hope that will take them in college.
Yeah, I kind of just want to echo what both of you have said. I think, Tara, on your point of, like, just not being afraid to write about identity, and specifically your Asian identity too. I think, yeah, that's something that I've also heard, to, like, you know, shy away from writing about your Asian identity in your college applications. But I don't think that's necessarily valid advice. I know that, like, in one of my essays, I wrote specifically about, like, the meaning of my name, and a lot of that had to do with my Asian identity and how I interpreted it. And I think that just being true to who you are and what your lived experiences are is just super critical.
But the fact of the matter is, the landscape of college admissions is facing major shifts. In the midst of COVID-19, traditional means of academic evaluation have completely gone out the window. High schools across the country have made the switch to pass-fail grading, as low-income students and students with disabilities struggle with remote learning. SATs and ACTs have been postponed as well, while AP testing online proves to be hapless. Dozens of colleges have already announced plans to waive standardized testing for applicants, Harvard being one of them, meaning that for this upcoming admission cycle, schools have no choice but to reconsider other ways of assessing student potential. And this could be a game changer. Here is Rob Franek, a nationally renowned expert at the Princeton Review, breaking down Care Counts in Crisis, a statement released by the Harvard Graduate School of Education on the changing nature of admissions during COVID-19. This document has been signed by over 315 and counting admissions deans from all 8 Ivy League schools, as well as from many top-tier universities and liberal arts colleges.
The first item in this document is all about self-care. I'm going to read you a direct quote from the document. We encourage all students to be gentle with themselves during this time. Folks, we again need to hear this and need to take some solace in it. The second thing is about academic work, and I'll read you a direct quote from there as well. We will assess your academic achievements in context of the obstacles that you faced. Folks, they will also say that they'll evaluate academic achievements mainly based on academic performance before and after the pandemic. They were explicit that you will not be disadvantaged because of a change in plans, because of the pandemic, or because of your school's decision about transcripts, or because of the absence of IB or AP testing, or because of the lack of access to standardized tests, or because you plain old weren't able to visit college campuses. You will be viewed in the context of the curriculum, academic resources, and supports that were available to you. Now, next, the document emphasizes the importance of service and contribution to others, and again, assessed in the context of the obstacles that you face. They were very clear that you shouldn't engage in any kind of competitive public service, and they explicitly said that what matters most to them is that whether your contributions or service is authentic and meaningful to you and to others. And again, they remind everybody reading that you will not be disadvantaged if you're not in a position to provide those contributions. Now, the next part of the document is all about family contribution. Admission leaders truly understand that due to the demands placed on your family as a result of the pandemic, you may have had responsibilities at home that you wouldn't otherwise have.
This is a time for reformation, for reimagining the ways admissions can become more equitable in the age of coronavirus and after. As Richard Weisbord, faculty director at the Harvard Graduate School for Education, puts it, what if it turns out that having the SAT or ACT didn't matter, that these colleges are still admitting students who are just as engaged and doing just as well without students having to experience the stress and stigma of high-stakes testing? This is an opportunity to try forms of assessment that don't clearly favor those with privilege. In anti-affirmative action rhetoric, there's a huge focus on test scores, GPAs, and an overall numeric lens on what qualifies someone for admissions into a top-tier school. As Asian American students, we are often told growing up that being Asian means we need perfect grades, that we need to score X amount of points above other racial groups, but framing admissions simply in the terms of point bonuses and penalties obscures the far more complex reality that is race-conscious admissions. Not only does it imply that there is an objective way of measuring one's intellectual worth, but it suggests that in the natural order of things, whites and Asians deserve to be on top, while other minorities should be shunned by these educational institutions. Even before the pandemic turned our world upside down, test scores and GPAs have never been the sole determinant in college admissions. In 2015, the Office of Civil Rights at the United States Department of Education released a report clearing Princeton University of bias against Asian American applicants. The 9-year investigation revealed that Asian American students have a tough time getting into Princeton because, well, everyone has a tough time getting into Princeton. 82% of valedictorians in the applicant pool for the class of 2010 were not admitted, and over 50% of applicants with perfect SAT-1 scores of 2400 were denied as well. The report also showed that the university frequently accepted Asian American students with grades and test scores significantly lower than those of some rejected non-Asian students. For these applications, the review board focused on other distinctions, like the applicant's extensive community service experience, or another's overcoming poverty, or one student's experience working in a family business. To make the playing field as equitable as possible, standardized test scores and GPAs should never be the only factors in admissions. Private tutoring, test prep, and sometimes illicit resources will always be available for families who can afford it. Last year's Operation Varsity Blues scandal proves just that.
When I've talked about affirmative action to my family as well, I think there's some of this narrative around college admissions being something where it should just only be about achievement. Which I think, you know, given that I've worked in the Amherst admissions office and talked to a lot of the admissions counselors and stuff, I think it's kind of misleading to think about college in that kind of way, because what a lot of admissions officers are actually looking for is kind of not just what someone has been able to achieve with what they've been given, but like, given that these very elite schools have so many resources, it's like, what can a potential student do with those resources once they come to our school? So I think a lot of the times people will say, like, oh, well, like, this subgroup of students had a much lower SAT score and lower GPA averages, so therefore they're not as qualified. But, you know, like, college admissions is really so complicated that you can't reduce whether or not someone gets admitted due to their score. It's like there's so much affecting that.
So what now? When we look beyond the numbers, the test percentiles and GPAs, we have real human stories, ones that speak more about ourselves than any SAT or ACT score. If there's a silver lining in our current situation, it's that there will be so many more creative avenues for students to express themselves to potential schools. As Richard Weisbird, whom I mentioned earlier, predicts, there will be a move towards evaluating student work over transcripts, whether it be samples of writing, art, music, anything that can showcase an applicant's abilities. And for the Asian American applicants listening right now, this is a unique opportunity for you to diversify the elements of your application, to break out of the box of what you exemplify to admissions counselors. Really use your essays to your advantage, and let them speak to the experiences you've had and the moments you're living through right now.
We are back with an unexpected side effect of this coronavirus crisis, Asian Americans becoming targets of discrimination. The FBI recently issued a warning about a potential spike in hate crimes. And just this week, the NYPD launched a social media campaign to raise awareness, tweeting, "Hate is an ugly word and it has no place in our vocabulary."
A federal judge is siding with Harvard in a landmark admissions case, ruling the university did not discriminate against Asian American applicants. But an appeal is already in the works. At issue is a lawsuit filed by a group called Students for Fair Admissions, which accused administrators of setting quotas for the number of Asian Americans.
This morning, Yale University is defending itself in a battle that could have major consequences for the future of affirmative action. The Justice Department is accusing the prestigious Ivy League school of violating federal civil rights law by discriminating against Asian Americans and white applicants.
Numerous Asian American groups in and outside of Georgia signed this letter saying, in part, "Today we call on our Asian American community to break that silence and commit to building solidarity with our black brothers and sisters. We must resoundingly exclaim that Black Lives Matter." The
Latin American now more than ever is the Asian community confronted by their ever-shifting status in American society. As of July 1st, over 800 incidents of harassment and discrimination against Asian Americans have been reported to Stop AAPI Hate over a three-month period. And this is just in California. Another study by San Francisco State University's Asian American Studies Department estimates that over 1,000 cases of coronavirus-related xenophobia occurred nationwide just between January and February alone. Use of the terms Chinese virus and Kung flu by news outlets and even the president himself have further normalized anti-Asian rhetoric.
Some important developments in our war against the Chinese virus. We'll be invoking the Defense Production Act just in case we need it.
Why do you keep calling this the Chinese virus? There are reports of dozens of incidents of bias against Chinese Americans in this country. Your own aide, Secretary Azar, says he does not use this term. He says ethnicity does not cause the virus. Why do you keep using this?
Because it comes from China.
A lot of people say it's racist.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China. That's why. It comes from China.
The person at the White House used the term Kung flu. My question is, do you think that's wrong, Kung flu? And do you think using the term Chinese virus, that puts Asian Americans at risk, that people might target them?
No, not at all. I think they probably would agree with it 100%. It comes from China. There's nothing not to agree. Okay, how about the last question?
Neither of the two leading public health agencies, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the World Health Organization, approve of the term Chinese virus, nor does the official U.S. website on COVID-19. Used by President Trump and like-minded politicians, the label Chinese virus purely serves to deflect blame from their own failings and lack of preparedness. When politicians conflate Chinese identity with the coronavirus, it sends a message to the rest of the country that Chineseness is somehow tied up with the virus itself. The stigma that becomes attached is that Chinese people, or anyone who looks Asian, can spread the disease. A new sort of yellow peril, discriminatory attitudes against Asian Americans become amplified by the ways those in power institutionalize racist language. When cornered by the rise of anti-Asian prejudice, President Trump offered a tweet on March 23rd stating that we should totally protect our Asian American community and we will prevail together. Yet, no federal measures were put in place following this empty gesture. Weeks later, the president returned to using Kung Flu and Chinese virus, despite reports of escalating violence. An acid attack on an Asian woman in Brooklyn. A Burmese-American man and his two young children, ages 2 and 6, gravely stabbed in Texas. The attacker plainly explained that he wanted to kill them for being Chinese and infecting people with the coronavirus. Today, Asian Americans face a sudden unmasking of their status in America. We are once again viewed as disease-carrying foreigners, a stereotype written into our history since the destruction of Chinatowns during the 1900s bubonic plague. It's strange to think that only a year ago we were touted as the right-wing's token minority, at the center of the affirmative action debate.
To speak on the topic of anti-Asian racism, it's definitely, I mean, not a welcome reminder, but a necessary reminder that for Asian people in the U.S. and for Asian Americans, that the reality of racialization and xenophobia are not escapable, because not that I think this by myself, but I think that across the country, a lot of people who may have adopted the mono-minority myth and kind of rested on that to see themselves as kind of protected and not really affected by racism, I feel like it was definitely a big reminder for people that that kind of experience is still very real for Asian Americans in the U.S. Like, at the end of the day, the racialization is really about what you look like and how people perceive you, and regardless of, you know, like, if you can get a certain education or make a certain amount of money, that doesn't change any of that.
This moment has just reminded me that Asian American solidarity with other BIPOC is just super critical. And I think it reminds me of this essay that I read by Mari Matsuda called Where Is Your Body? Where she basically says that as Asian Americans, we're the racial bourgeoisie, like we're the racial middle class. And she says that we have the choice to either ally ourselves with white people and white supremacy, or we have the choice to ally ourselves with other people of color. And she just like really pushes Asian Americans to think about their positionality in the U.S. and what kind of choices they're making. And I think in the moment of COVID and BLM, when you're seeing like anti-Asian racism because of COVID, and then also all these like systemic issues that make it so much harder for Black and Brown folks to seek the proper treatment for like COVID, and you still see continuing cases of police brutality, which BLM protesters are fighting against. I think all of those issues just go to like highlight and reinforce how important it is for Asian Americans to ally themselves with other BIPOC and not just think that we're close enough to whiteness that we can like get by. And it's kind of like echoing what Olivia was saying about how we're kind of seen as perpetually foreign. And no matter how hard we try to rise in mobility and status to white folks, like we will always be seen as perpetually foreign.
Before we talk about the two admissions controversies dominating the media at the moment, here's Craig Benzine from Crash Course on the legal history behind affirmative action.
So while affirmative action started with LBJ ordering government agencies to pursue policies that increased the employment of minorities in their own ranks and in soliciting contracts, the first time it made a splash at the Supreme Court was over the issue of university education, specifically in the landmark case of Regents of the University of California versus Bakke in 1973. The court ruled on the issue of racial set-asides, or quotas, in admissions at the University of California Davis Medical School. Of the 100 slots available to incoming med students, 16 were set aside for racial minorities. Bakke claimed that this meant that some people who were less qualified than he was, at least he felt so, got into Davis Med School and Baki didn't. So he sued, claiming that the quotas discriminated against him because he was white. The Supreme Court ruled in Baki's favor, saying that racial quotas were not allowed since they didn't provide equal opportunity. But they also ruled that affirmative action programs were allowed if they served a compelling government interest and were narrowly tailored to meet that interest. In other words, if they passed the test of strict scrutiny. What they did say was a compelling government interest was ensuring diversity in university admissions. This is true in general, and as long as we can imagine there being universities, the state has an interest in seeing that their classes represent diverse viewpoints. Diversity benefits both the members of the minority and majority groups, at least in the minds of the courts. Two relatively recent cases involving the University of Michigan show how complicated it can be. In the 2003 case of Gratz versus Bollinger, the court ruled that Michigan's undergraduate admissions policy, which awarded extra points to people in racial minority groups, was unconstitutional because it was not narrowly tailored to meeting the goal of student body diversity. In the same year, in the case of Grutter versus Bollinger, Bollinger just keeps showing up at the Supreme Court because he was the president of the University of Michigan at the time. Lucky. The court ruled that the admissions policy of Michigan's law school was narrowly tailored to meet the goal of promoting diversity, although it said that in 25 years such a program might not be necessary. So, at the time we're making this episode, the idea that universities can take race into account in their admissions so that they can create a diverse learning environment for their students is still constitutional. But the Supreme Court looks very carefully at the actual policy that the university has in place, and if it looks anything like a quota, they'll strike it down.
In our previous episodes, we unpacked the context behind the recent Harvard admissions case and its impact on Asian American communities. We discussed Edward Blum's tactics in promoting anti-diversity under the disguise of protecting Asian American interests after his original campaign against affirmative action, the 2016 Fisher v. University of Texas case, was ruled in favor of race-conscious admissions by the Supreme Court. Now, with an updated Asian American face, anti-affirmative action movements hide the fact that they are mostly protecting white conservative interests over any other group. Data shows that Asian Americans, though only making up about 5% of the U.S. population, are represented fivefold across the nation's most selective schools, directly contrasting against accusations that Asian applicants are egregiously underrepresented. At the same time, though, we can still also acknowledge that Asian Americans are discounted against to some degree. This recent Harvard case highlights the implicit biases that are at play in the ways individual admissions counselors read Asian American applicants, or how high school counselors and teachers tend to write less noteworthy recommendations for their Asian students. But, as Frank Wu, renowned law professor and author, questions, if SFFA's motivations were to solely advocate for the Asian American community, then why was there no mention of actually correcting anti-Asian discrimination? Why did they jump straight to eliminating affirmative action when, in fact, affirmative action procedures can actually benefit Asians, especially in the professional workplace where many of us still face a bamboo ceiling? Why are they targeting a mechanism that, though imperfect, is dedicated to redressing social and economic inequities that actually supports marginalized Asian Americans from first-gen low-income backgrounds? But more telling, how is it that just a year ago, the same right-wing leaders that enlisted Asian students as anti-diversity mascots, the same ones now participating in anti-Asian rhetoric and causing harm to their so-called model minority?
I guess for me, it's really strange to see how the narrative around Asian American identity has like shifted so quickly, because I know just a year ago we were talking about Asian Americans in the affirmative action debate, and white conservatives were using Asian Americans to kind of mascot that, oh, this is the model minority, and they've kind of pulled themselves up from the bootstraps and they're doing well now, and how that was utilized as a way to take down affirmative action, one of the cornerstones of civil rights. It was a result of a lot of activism on part of Black organizers in the 60s, and how now, fast forwarding a year later, we're kind of now seen once again as not the model minority, but as people coming in carrying diseases, and how that's such a quick shift from how we were originally portrayed as a year ago.
What you said about the kind of narrative around Asian Americans shifting so quickly, it kind of reminded me of that op-ed that Andrew Yang wrote. I think it was in March, right? We talked about it in our Asian American representation class. But yeah, I just thought it's interesting that that was kind of the message that he immediately sent out when he had such a big platform of urging people to lean more into the model minority myth and, you know, like contribute to the cause and prove how good and how deserving we are to be Americans and kind of that message. But it was interesting to see how much backlash it got as well. And I think that people were very quick to, like, now in this moment, seeing the discrepancy between the message from that op-ed and what was going on in the world, that it was easier for people to identify why that kind of approach was kind of messed up. Whereas I think of a year ago when it was like in the middle of the affirmative action debate, I don't know if there would have been such a strong response against what he was kind of advocating for in his op-ed.
Last October, after about a year of deliberation by federal judge Allison Burroughs, the Harvard admissions case was ruled in favor of the university. Judge Burroughs wrote in her decision that the institution's admissions policies do not discriminate against Asian American applicants, nor do they use racial quotas. Burroughs defended Harvard's race-conscious admissions process and highlighted that though race was considered a small part of the holistic review, it was never used against an applicant. During trial, Harvard argued that basing decisions on solely grades and test scores would be impossible, as official files report that the school received 37,000 applications for roughly only 2,000 spots in the class of 2019, within which 8,000 of those applicants had perfect grades and more than 5,000 had a perfect math or verbal SAT score. Consideration of other factors, such as extracurriculars, volunteer work, personal stories, and race, is necessary to help colleges differentiate between applicants and achieve a more diverse class than it could produce through test scores and GPAs alone. However, Burroughs did point out that despite the lack of evidence supporting an institutional level of bias against Asian applicants, there are several ways in which implicit biases of individual actors can affect applicant reviews. Ultimately, though, the ruling upholds the right of universities and colleges to consider race as a factor of a factor in order to be more accessible for marginalized students, particularly in this time when power and influence have become ever so unbalanced across racial and socioeconomic lines. In February of this past year, Students for Fair Admissions filed an appeal in the First Circuit Court with an oral argument scheduled for September. The United States Justice Department has also filed an amicus brief claiming that Harvard University imposes a racial penalty by systematically disfavoring Asian American applicants. Many expect the case to eventually reach the Supreme Court. In addition to publicly backing the Harvard lawsuit, the United States Justice Department has also recently accused Yale University of violating federal law after a brief two-year investigation into the institution's admissions process. In the letter, released mid-August, the DOJ claims that Yale violated Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 by using race not as one of many factors, but as a predominant or determining factor in admissions, in turn placing Asian American and white applicants at a disadvantage. In one of the investigation's most striking claims, federal officials concluded that Asian American and white students have only 1/10 to 1/4 of the likelihood of admission as African-American applicants with comparable credentials. The data for this conclusion has yet to be publicized, but it echoes a 2005 study conducted by Princeton that estimated Asian-American students must score 140 points more than white counterparts on the SAT, 270 points more than Latino students, and 450 points above Black students. Though understandably concerning, these statistics should not be taken at face value until their parameters are understood. For example, the author of the Princeton study, Thomas Espenshade, publicly stated that he did not believe his data established bias against Asian American applicants, as it does not take into account softer variables such as teacher and high school counselor recommendations, essays, and lists of extracurricular activities that may help explain some of the data's discrepancies. Similarly, the investigation held by the U.S. Justice Department fails to define the measurement of comparable credentials to which they are supposedly holding to applicant data.
Yale fired back, saying it looks at the whole person when considering admission. The department's allegation is baseless, the university's president wrote. At this unique moment in our history, when so much attention properly is being paid to issues of race, Yale will not waver in its commitment to educating a student body whose diversity is a mark of its excellence.
Highly unusual to suggest you got major findings in a case in discrimination where you're issuing a four-page letter that basically gives you no underlying facts.
So what's next? Well, the Justice Department's letter is not a lawsuit, at least not yet. Yale has until later this month to agree to suspend the use of race in admissions. If it doesn't, all this could end up in court for years.
The university maintains in a release statement that it has cooperated fully with the investigation and has been continually turning over a substantial amount of information and data. Their statement follows. Given our commitment to complying with federal law, we are dismayed that the DOJ has made its determination before allowing Yale to provide all the information the department has requested thus far. Had the department fully received and fairly weighed this information, it would have concluded that Yale's practices absolutely comply with decades of Supreme Court precedent. It's crucial to also understand that the U.S. Justice Department is not a neutral party to the topic of affirmative action. From the onset, the Trump administration has set its sights on politicizing the DOJ. Since taking the helm of the department, Attorney General William Barr has become widely viewed as the president's personal attack dog and accomplice. Ramping up the partisan nature of the DOJ, Barr has instigated numerous attacks against the left, from the department's challenge of COVID-19 public health orders in support of conservative and right-wing religious protesters, to the DOJ's condemnation of Black Lives Matter activism as far-left extremism. Eliminating affirmative action seems to be just another strategy of the DOJ's increasingly conservative political agenda. Anurima Bhargava, former chief of the Educational Opportunities section of the Civil Rights Division at DOJ, states that, quote, "This announcement is pure politics, a signal once again that the Trump administration will take extraordinary steps to protect white privilege and resort to unfounded racial attacks right on the heels of Kamala Harris, a Black and Asian American woman, joining the top of the Democratic ticket," end quote.
It almost feels like it's never ending. Like, they'll just keep suing every single elite university out there until they get the result that they want. But yeah, I think that, like, in terms of conversations and, like, things I've been thinking about, I think that there's a vocal conservative component of Asian Americans who just keep speaking out against affirmative action when in reality there's been, like, polls done and surveys done where the majority of Asian Americans do support affirmative action and have either historically or currently directly benefited from affirmative action. So I just think that there's, like, a lot of false narratives being circulated. And at least when, like, the Harvard lawsuit was going on, there was almost, like, a lack of questioning behind, like, who is behind these lawsuits. And when we, like, showed up to court, there was a group of us who showed up and, like, supported the student testimonies for affirmative action. And we just saw this stark difference between SFFA, which was all white lawyers, that side was completely white. And then our side was a very diverse group going in and supporting student testimonies. And I think that in itself is just very telling in terms of who is behind this lawsuit, what is the goal of this lawsuit. And even though it proclaimed to benefit Asian Americans in the Harvard admissions case, like, at the end of the day, that's not what they're trying to do. Instead, it's a way to just keep reinforcing white supremacy. And I think that in terms of, like, the Asian American student population during the Harvard admissions case, I do think there was quite a range of perspectives and opinions. But at least in my circle, within TAPAs, the Task Force on Asian and Pacific American Studies, but basically, yeah, amongst that circle, there was a lot of Asian American students really pushing for affirmative action and showing our support on that end.
Yeah, I think for me, one of my biggest frustrations about how people talk about the affirmative action case is that there's such a huge conflation of kind of like the merits of affirmative action and the idea of anti-Asian discrimination, which I feel like are very separate issues that aren't necessarily connected, but they've tried to connect those two issues and make it into one in order to say that like Asians should be against affirmative action. But I was having a conversation with one of my high school friends a few weeks ago, and we were talking about how there is one council member in our hometown on the city council who is Chinese, and he's very conservative, very anti-affirmative action, but we noticed that he is very quick to kind of co-opt a lot of social justice language in order to kind of explain why Asian Americans should be against affirmative action. A lot of that language is about like, oh, they're discriminating against Asian people. They're putting like, it's oppression against Asian Americans, and like, where they're very quick to use that kind of vocabulary to draw that connection between discrimination and then like applying that onto affirmative action. Because I feel like in the case, like focusing specifically on Asian American students, I can definitely see why there are Asian Americans who may be worried about like kind of stereotypes that admissions officers have about Asian students, you know, like the idea of Asian students being unpersonable and kind of working very hard but not having leadership skills. I think those are kind of pretty long-standing stereotypes of Asian people that have, you know, existed. So I can definitely see why people connect with that kind of message, but at the same time, it's like the issue of affirmative action really is something I feel like entirely separate from that. Because yeah, I just feel like they talk about affirmative action in a way that's very like disattached from its historical roots and why it existed in the first place. Like the whole point of affirmative action is to help remedy like a lot of the systematic inequalities that exist in the first place. It's not like about giving certain people an unfair advantage. It's like if someone else already has an unfair advantage, so it's trying to even that out and give more people opportunity.
In fact, a 2016 study conducted by University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill found that eliminating African American and Latino applicants from the Harvard admissions pool increases the admissions chances of Asian Americans by only 1%, making it quite unlikely that rejected Asian American applicants would be admitted even under a system that does not consider race. This discrepancy, the researchers noted, was because underrepresented minorities that stand to benefit from affirmative action only make up a small portion of the applicant pool in the first place. The elimination of race-conscious admissions, as concluded by the study, would not result in significant change for Asian Americans, and instead, white students would overwhelmingly benefit from its disposal.
There is this phenomenon of white affirmative action, and it's called legacy admissions in universities.
They give preference to alumni children who also make up, at a lot of elite schools, 10 to 20% of the population.
That's an affirmative action.
Right, it's an affirmative action for the wealthy.
In the Justice Department's recent accusations against Harvard and Yale, they skip over an intriguing facet of college admissions, namely legacy donor admissions and athlete recruitment. The National Bureau of Economic Research published a study last year showing that 43% of white students admitted to Harvard were recruited athletes, legacy students, and children of faculty. This number also includes the dean's interest list, which is composed of donor applicants. Out of the white students admitted from these categories, the study shows that 75% of them would have been rejected normally. Here's what Hassan Minhaj, host of the Patriot Act, has to say.
If these Asian parents really cared about the numbers and fairness, they would be going after legacy admissions first, not attacking affirmative action. Now, this entire affirmative action issue is really a debate on how we define merit. And there are two camps. Are you just your GPA and your SAT score? Or do a myriad of factors determine who you are? I fall in that camp. I support affirmative action, and the majority of Asian Americans do too. I get that affirmative action is an imperfect system. Does the software need updating? Of course. Look, I'm not saying you shouldn't sue to right a wrong. There was another moment in history over 40 years ago in San Francisco when Asian Americans felt like they were being denied educational opportunities. Asian immigrants were struggling in school because they couldn't speak English and their schools weren't helping them. So they filed a class action lawsuit that went all the way to the Supreme Court.
The 1974 court decision called Lau versus Nichols. That court case became the wellspring for almost every bilingual school program in America.
With the help of groups such as Chinese for Affirmative Action, students can successfully be multilingual and multicultural.
America has English as a second language because of Chinese for Affirmative Action. It was a landmark decision that made education more accessible for everyone. Now that is a lawsuit. If the plaintiffs hadn't won that case, the students wouldn't have been able to learn. But if the plaintiffs don't win the Harvard case, the students have to live with the cold, harsh reality that they might have to go to the UC Santa Cruz of the Ivies. Cornell. And for those in the Asian community who keep insisting, we just want equality, we're American citizens, treat us like Americans, fine. But if you are willing to act like racism isn't a thing, team up with lawyers, and then take it to the courts when you don't get your way, you're right. You truly are an American. You just happen to be the worst kind.
One of the reasons that this case was brought against Harvard was simply to leverage the name of Harvard and the prestige of Harvard in service of this goal of the man, Edward Bloom, who brought this case, who is very much an anti-affirmative action activist. He is trying to bring down affirmative action throughout the country, and he is using Harvard because he knew that it would be a lightning rod. And I think that we have to be, to try to focus on the movement here, which is the movement against equity for people of color that this is part of, that, you know, Edward Bloom also runs an organization called People for Fair Representation. This is a group that is actively involved in supporting the citizenship question on the census. So the idea that he has brought the suit to help Asian Americans, this is not a man who is a friend of our community. And so I think, again, it's very important to be aware of the larger movements involved here, the larger political movements, and who we are aligned with.
We see that if this narrative of Asian Americans as a wedge succeeds, then it is the death of the Rainbow Coalition, which brought about the civil rights movement and all of the changes that we are sort of benefiting from, although many of them have been rolled back. So that's why we're involved in this, because we want to fight back against that narrative and preserve the solidarity that we have with other communities of color.
This question of solidarity that Jeannie Park and Nicole Gonocchi addressed in a panel held over a year ago is one that heavily resonates right now in our current historical moment.
It is our duty to fight for our freedom! We must love and protect each other.
We must love and protect each other.
Have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
Have nothing to lose but our chains.
We have nothing to lose but our chains.
The year is 2020, and we are witnessing protests around the world after the police killing of George Floyd, an unarmed African American. A white Minneapolis police officer was filmed kneeling on his neck as he pleaded, "I can't breathe," for nearly 9 minutes. His death comes less than 3 months after police shot dead health worker Breonna Taylor in her home in a no-knock search warrant. And only 3 weeks after video surfaced online of a father and son shooting dead Ahmaud Arbery, who was out jogging. And even as protesters in every state continue to rail against systematic racism and the use of deadly force, another killing occurs. Only 18 days into the George Floyd protests, a white police officer shoots dead Rayshard Brooks outside of a Wendy's restaurant in Atlanta.
Another black person dying at the hands of the police, screaming, "I can't breathe." But this time we cannot stay silent, especially the Asian community. The officer who's blocking people off, he's Hmong American. He's my age. He's 34. The guy who owns the store, did you know this? He's Arab American. His clerk called the cops on Floyd. That is America. A black man was murdered in cold blood, and we were on the fucking sidelines
watching. I'm not saying we were the ones who killed George Floyd, but we have to be the ones who pull that cop off his neck. We think we're not a part of the story, but we're at the scene of the crime. That's why the full picture matters. This doesn't happen in a vacuum. It happens in a system.
To my Asian American listeners, perhaps this isn't where you expected the episode to lead, but this is no longer a gentle reminder. Race and access are so deeply and painfully intertwined. For many of those in our Asian communities, we are also once again reminded of our own mortality as anti-Asian racism escalates in the U.S. at the hands of right-wing conservatives. When we center Asian American political identity on the denial of affirmative action, we're sending a message that we don't care about other minority groups, the same communities that have fought for our civil rights to be here in this country. We can no longer be complicit. We can no longer turn a blind eye to systemic racism and violence against Black and Brown communities. We can no longer turn away mutely from the microaggressions and prejudices enacted by our own Asian family members and friends. We can no longer, as Hasan Minhaj powerfully puts it, stand on the sidelines while police brutalize Black people, Black children every single day.
Especially now that a lot of us have been having conversations with our families about everything going on with Black Lives Matter and police brutality. And I know, at least for my family and for many of my friends as well, that oftentimes it can be very challenging to have those kinds of conversations, because I feel like there's a lot of differences in both where first-generation immigrants are getting their information from. I know my parents, a lot of that is news from WeChat, which, you know, sometimes is not very accurate or sometimes just has like a very particular slant to it. And there's not really a full representation, especially of a lot of progressive views on WeChat, but also just kind of a very different context of where they grew up, because I know for my parents that oftentimes what they see in America, they will always just compare to how they grew up in China. It's definitely something that's difficult to communicate, and it's become much more apparent to me like how different of a perspective I have from my parents' generation. And that's not to say that there aren't like very progressive first generation Chinese immigrants, or like my mom, for example, is a huge supporter of affirmative action, and she's been doing a lot of reading and learning about Black Lives Matter as well, which I think is really great. But also there's a lot of challenges in communication. I think it's definitely a good thing, but at the same time, it can be like a really big mental health toll on our generation as well, to feel like we like have to single-handedly change their minds about so many of these issues that have been, like, their views may be really ingrained in how they grew up and their experiences in life as well. So I just think it's very complicated, and it's definitely something that will require a lot more kind of long-term dedication to see a lot of big change and shifts in the community. But I guess it's a little early to tell, given that it's only been a few months, but it's definitely something that I've been thinking about a lot recently.
Yeah, it's a lot, but I think the important part is getting it on their radar and emphasizing it to them over and over that this is a big deal and this does affect us as Asian Americans, even though, you know, what you're seeing on the news, it might not seem like it's our fight to partake in, but if you peel back the layers, there's so much history behind, you know, Asian American discrimination that, you know, is tied up with a lot of the ways that white supremacy and white norms, it has all trickled down to impact minorities in a similar way. And because of that, we have to keep on doing the work to educate ourselves and our families and those around us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree with having to do the continued work and it taking time, and not just having the conversations in this moment in time, but also like continuing to have them. I think, yeah, for me, with talking to my parents, I've found that like using terms or trying to translate terms like white supremacy or like systemic and things like that just has been like incredibly difficult. And so the best way that I've found to get through to them is just also to like hear their perspectives and kind of the context that they're coming from and try to create like either hypothetical scenarios or just put situations in their context, something that they can relate to and think about. And I've found that a lot easier than like using terms or jargon that they might not understand or takes a lot of explaining on my end. And I don't have the language abilities to do that.
I think especially now with Black Lives Matter that a lot of people in our generation have been really galvanized to have those kinds of tough conversations with their families, which I think is a really great thing. Because, you know, like besides from their own children, maybe some of these parents wouldn't even be getting any kind of progressive views.
My parents tend to say that, oh, this isn't our fight because it's not about Asian Americans. This doesn't affect Asian Americans. And therefore, we should kind of just keep our head down and not really speak up. And that's a mentality that I feel like my parents have ingrained in me since I was very little. It's the whole keep your head down, do your work. Do well in school and then you're going to be set for life. And especially for someone like me who comes from a first gen low income background, I think it has carried me this far into college. And now that I've graduated college, it feels like now I'm becoming aware of all of the inequities that still keep me from being, you know, successful in their eyes, at least like in their idea of the American dream. Like there's still so many things that we have to overcome. And a lot of it has to do with race and the way that, you know, us minorities are being treated in regards to one another, but also like to the system as a whole. There's so many things that needs fixing. And all of these complexities are so hard to explain to your parents when you have limited language to do so. So yeah, I'm still struggling with having these conversations, but you just need to keep pushing through and keep bringing it up and point out when like family members say something that's not right. And even though I still fight with them a lot, I think they're slowly getting to really understand where I'm coming from, even if it's like one little step at a time.
From statements and resources released by organizations such as Asian Americans Advancing Justice to crowdsource movements like Letters for Black Lives, or the anti-racism materials compiled by groups like Daisy's Rising Up and Moving, or the Southeast Asian Diaspora Project, were participating in a rich history of Black and Asian solidarity. The term Asian American itself was coined in 1968 by UC Berkeley students who were inspired by the Black Power movement. These same students, inspiring university coalitions across the country, marched alongside Black and Brown organizers as part of the Third World Liberation Front. Together, students of color rallied for equal education opportunities and the creation of ethnic studies programs. Asian American activists like Grace Lee Boggs and Yuri Kochiyama heavily aligned themselves with Black social justice movements and advocated for Black radical thinking in their own communities. These are the lineages, the historical roots we come from.
I'm thinking a lot about like ethnic studies curriculum or anti-racist curriculum and pedagogies. And so even though this isn't necessarily specific to AAPI issues, I do think that like there's now like a moment in time where people are seeing the necessity of an anti-racist education and really thinking about how our education needs to provide both windows and mirrors. And what I mean by that is windows where you can see into other people's experiences, and then also mirrors where you see your own identity and who you are reflected in your education. I've been thinking about in terms of just like students of color in generally, but also I think it has a lot of application to AAPI students, because I feel like that was just a huge gap in my K-12 education, where when we talked about race, it was very like black and white, and I had no idea how to situate myself in like this landscape of social justice, or just like the US landscape generally. And I think that in this moment in time with the resurgence of Black Lives Matter, if students had been educated in an anti-racist manner in ethnic studies and like culturally relevant pedagogy and all these things earlier on, we wouldn't have to be doing all the learning now. We wouldn't have to be having all the book clubs now. We could instead be taking action and knowing what to do, what to say, and how to act in these moments in time.
When it comes to the racial inequities that have always undergirded our society, there is absolutely nothing novel about the age of coronavirus. Our podcast began with the hope of illuminating dialogue around affirmative action, a thoroughly flawed but necessary preservation of civil rights. And as we've figured out, it is only one small facet of a larger, more complicated conundrum about how to create a more equitable society. But one thing is clear. As a resonant unified voice, we, the Asian American community, must stand in solidarity with other marginalized groups in the fight, as Dr. Oyem Poon puts it, for racial justice and not just us.
The United States of America is a nation where people are not united because of those three glaring frailties: racism, injustices, and inequities. It is up to all of us to fight this mental and emotional pollution wherever and whenever it is detected.
The legacy I would like to leave is that people try to build bridges and not walls.
And with the compelling words of the late Yuri Kochiyama, I thank you, listener, for tuning into this episode of Veritas, The Truth Behind Asian Americans and Affirmative Action. For more information on how to help support communities of color during COVID-19 and Black Lives Matter, please visit nfgtheneighborhoodfundersgroup.org and join CampaignZero.org. This is Tara, signing off. Please, stay safe out there.